Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa. Good to be back.
It is good to be here and into show number 20.
We're moving right along.
We are.
Yeah.
20. Can you believe it? It's been 20 programs already? Actually, I should count up how many programs we've done from the beginning. That would really be interesting.
That's for sure. Yeah, that would be a buku bunch.
A lot and very, very much fun.
Great.
All right.
Well, we're going to be looking at a whole bunch of saints today. This is one of those great eras of saints. In fact, as I was reading a recent article from the New Cambridge History of Europe, which is not particularly a Catholic or pro-Catholic a publication, one of the observations that the author made was, as he was trying to describe the phenomenon of the revival of the Catholic Church, which certainly by 1500 or 1520, 1535, a lot of people had prematurely announced its death, much like Mark Twain. And all of a sudden you find within 50 more years, the Catholic Church is stronger than it's been in the last several hundred years. And as he was trying to describe the political reasons for that and the economic reasons for that and all that, he finally gave up and said, well, the fact of the matter is that there were more saints during this period of time than any time since the 13th century.
Right.
And I bet you if you sat down and looked at canonized saints, you would probably find even more than in the 13th century, which was, of course, the splendid century of church history. So, and what we've looked at so far, of course, is a number of popes who have been Reformation popes and have really taken the lead. And I think the last one that we spoke about was Pope Paul the IV, who died in 1559. He died a broken man. And died very sadly, and died very hated. And it wouldn't be until a number of years later that people could go back and really begin to assess, once again, his papacy, but even more than that, his life.
Mm-hmm.
And if we've seen time after time, his papacy was really torpedoed by his three nephews,
right,
including Cardinal Carlos, the Secretary of State. And it's only in the last weeks of his life that he came to realize how these guys had been stabbing him in the back without him knowing it,
mm-hmm,
and then repudiated them. And as I say, spent the last several weeks of his life in penance for having followed their advice. There's a story that goes that two Roman wags were talking to each other, and one of them says to the other one, he says, "Oh, there's strong medicine, there's strong wine in that carafe." You know, it's a takeoff on his name. It's a pun because remember his family name is Caraffa.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and the response back is, "Oh, that's not wine, that's vinegar." You know, but it also reminds you, too, of the statement that St. Francis de Sales, who was not yet even born, would later on would be the one that would popularize the statement, you can catch more flies with honey than you can with vinegar.
Right.
And we're going to see so many of these just wonderful popes who are going to be doing, and wonderful saints who are going to be doing that very thing. So while the church needs discipline, and we've certainly had a good portion of that on the during the papacy of Paul the IV, we'll see that the popes that follow afterwards are going to use other kinds of medicine. For instance, the next pope to be elected during the conclave of 1559 will be John Angelo de' Medici.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not the de' Medici family of Florence,
okay,
which has had a long history and all. But this is the Milanese de' Medici's.
Okay.
From Milan.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The conclave itself is going to last some 3 months, so it's going to be a relatively long conclave. But eventually they'll choose him. He will have 6 years to do something, and he chooses the title Pope Pius the IV. So we've gone from a Paul the IV to a Pius the IV,
mm-hmm,
okay? And one of the things he does is he does the very same thing that his predecessor did. He finds one of his nephews and makes him the Secretary of State.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And we've seen that sometimes that's not the best thing to do. But it all depends on the personality of the nephew. And in this case, it's St. Charles Borromeo.
So that sounds like it might be a good choice.
Yes, and it was. It was an excellent choice. Yeah, it really was. Charles Borromeo has an interesting life story himself. He's born to a wealthy, well-connected family, and very early in his young adulthood, came across the Ignatian exercises, which of course are quite new. And he takes the exercises, and after he finished, he did exactly as St. Ignatius would love to see people do, finishing those exercises, and that is that he reordered his life. He gave his life over to God, and he began living a life of austere simplicity. Further, then, he would continue the reforms, and his uncle, Pius the Fourth, would continue the reforms of Pope Paul the Fourth, but in a much less severe way than Paul had done. He also convinces his uncle, the Pope, that he should live a more austere life also. He didn't need all the trappings of the papacy around him, and ultimately it led to trimming down the number of courtiers at the papal court by 400.
Okay.
You know, go out and get a real job. Yeah, and he continued working in the Vatican, always wanting to go to Milan and institute the reforms of Trent at Milan. He was only allowed to do that when his uncle died and was replaced by Pius V, who would later on be canonized himself. In 1566, then Charles Borromeo was able to return to Milan as the Cardinal Archbishop. And at that time, using gentle persuasion and Christian example, he did much to reform the clergy and the people of his diocese. He died at the age of 46.
Wow.
And he died while volunteering in Milanese hospitals in helping plague victims.
Wow.
That's something that's
beautiful.
A heroic life and a heroic death. There are a number of others during the same era that it would be good for us to talk about and in some ways go back and catch some of these. I'd like to start out with like Thomas More and say some things about him, and then go through a number of other saints during this period, reminding us that during the Reformation period, there were saints already. Mm-hmm. There was Reformation already underway. We have to keep this in mind because we always have to keep within perspective that abuse theory, which is the theory that the church was utterly and irreformably corrupted. Along come these sincere Bible Christians from Luther through Zwingli, through Bucer, through Munzer, through Calvin, Knox, on and on and on, and that they returned the church to its pristine glory of the pre-Constantine era. That's the whole long and short of the abuse theory, and it simply doesn't hold water when you scratch beneath the surface and you start looking at Cardinal Ximenes de Cisneros and everything that was going on in Spain at the time, at individual bishops in everything, and unfortunately in relatively small dioceses. Mm-hmm. Dioceses like Carpentras in southern France or Chieti in Italy with Cardinal Carafa and others. So there is Reformation already underway, even some attempts in areas of Germany. So we always keep that in mind, and always keep in mind, too, that there are saints who are still around, and many of them living heroic lives and dying for their faith. And so I think the first one that really stands out for us is St. Thomas More, born around 1475. So he's no spring chicken by the time Martin Luther, he's a contemporary with Martin Luther, dies in 1535, an unnatural death, execution. He is one of the great humanists of the age, a friend of Erasmus.
Right.
The author of the book Utopia, where he looks at the best case scenario for human society, a society that's built on natural virtues. And of course, as we've mentioned a number of times, this was a reading from Charles V, the emperor, who wanted to see this applied and use this as as the constitution, basically, for the establishment of a city in Mexico, Puebla de los Ángeles, and for the first several years succeeded in building a city that was meant to be that utopia.
What was the reason it ended up failing?
It ended up failing because the other side of human nature came in.
Okay.
You had a lot of conquistadors who came to Mexico. You remember the three motivations are gold, glory, and gospel.
Right.
And in many cases, the order, like for instance, when you look at somebody like Hernando Cortez, the order of that little gestalt, in a sense, was first of all glory, then gospel, and then gold. We know that because he constantly gave up wealth in order to go out and do more glory mongering. And at the same time, all of his glory mongering always involved spreading the gospel. So here's a layman who was a soldier and an adventurer and an explorer, but always carries the cross with him. You know, and so there are a lot of men like that, a lot of women like that, who really built the New World.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there are others who had the gestalt built in a different way, in which it was gold, and then maybe glory, and then maybe gospel, or maybe not gospel at all. And it seems as though what happened in around Puebla was that a number of these settlers, these Spanish settlers, took what began to be a very beautiful process of using the resources of the area and using the native skills of the Native Americans, who were very fine craftsmen, and then adding to that the technology of Spain,
mm-hmm.
Particularly what the Spanish had gotten from the Moors. And as a result of all of that coming together, you ended up with the Talavera tile industry. Ceramic tile.
Beautiful tile.
And an incredible art that comes from that. And all that looks to be very fine until these guys come in and find a way to exploit that in what they call the encomienda process, which was this supposed relationship in which Native Americans would act as indentured servants in exchange for the knowledge of the technology. Well, that didn't. They got the raw deal on that,
right?
And that's why Puebla, although it starts out and is this perfect society, ends up being less than perfect, and then you have to go through a lot of changes, and it's a struggle to take centuries.
Okay,
you know, but human nature is
just
gets into that stuff. Anyway, that was the idea, and he's the author. Thomas More is the author of this book, Utopia. He's also author of, he's sort of the ghostwriter also of another tract that is attributed to Henry VIII, in which he defends the Catholic faith and attacks Martin Luther's propositions. And for that, of course, Henry receives the award of the medal of the Defender of the Faith, the title that goes with that. But most people believe that Thomas More is actually the author behind that. He replaces Cardinal Wolsey, as we're all well aware of. And once again, I just really recommend a good movie, Man for All Seasons, which does a really wonderful job of the history behind this period and the sense behind it. He does not advance the cause of the divorce of Henry VIII from Catherine of Aragon, because he believes that Catherine is the legitimate Queen of England and the legitimate wife of Henry. It's a sticky situation that goes on for 3 years, and he's able to maintain himself and his household, Thomas More, basically through silence. And he's able to do that, and most of the church in England is able to do that, maneuvering around the king and his concupiscence without anybody getting hurt, killed. And then what happens in 1534 is that there is an incident in which there is a little servant girl, she's deranged, and her name is Elizabeth Barton, and she begins preaching She's nicknamed the Nun of Kent because she's doing this around Kent. And what she does is she's kind of inspired to stand up. She's sort of the little child with, you know, this story of the emperor without clothes. Mm-hmm. She basically is the only one that stands up, points to the king, and says, you know, you cannot divorce the queen, and you must recognize papal supremacy in church matters. Well, the long and short of it is that she is executed for treason, and along with that, she had a number of priests who were supporters of her who thought, well, you know, she's speaking the truth, and what's going to happen is that the whole of the nation will rise up against the king and put him in his place. Well, that didn't happen. And so anyway, all of these were executed, and then what happens is that the king then uses the Act of Succession. He has Parliament pass an Act of Succession, which is tied to the Treason Act. And there, anyone of any importance has to answer the basic question. And the basic question is, who is the rightful heir to the throne? Is it Mary, the daughter of Catherine, right, or is it Elizabeth, the daughter of Anne?
Right.
And if you answer it wrong, you get your head cut off. Well, with that, there's nothing that Thomas More could do, Bishop Fisher, a good number of others, and they were taken to the Tower of London and then, of course, ultimately executed after these mock trials. Everyone knew that the king used prejudiced evidence in presenting these things, but there it was. And by 1535, Henry VIII had blood on his hands, and then shortly after that, Anne Boleyn would also be executed, and this just starts this spiral downhill. There's, once again, I'm going to quote you from the New Cambridge Modern History.
Okay.
And as I say, this is no particular friend of the Catholic Church. But this, as they're looking at Henry itself, they said the following. They said, Henry's reputation as a sanguinary monster was well established. While one must admit the king's intelligence and political skill, one really cannot deny that there is much truth in this verdict of contemporaries and others. So there you go. Nowadays, we've lauded this guy in song and named restaurants after him and all this kind of stuff and had big, you know, medieval banquets and that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is that he was a ruthless character who was motivated mainly out of his sexual lusts, mm-hmm, and went through six wives. And it was notorious in his age. Now, contrast that with Thomas More,
right,
you know, and his last words to his daughter Margaret are so ringing. He says this, he says, nothing can come but what God wills, and I am very sure that whatever that may be, however bad it may seem, it shall indeed be the best. Mm. Well, you know, it's his death, that's what it is,
mm-hmm,
but at the same time, his death, there is good that's going to come from that because it'll give such example to all of us,
right,
ever since. Yeah. Well, around the same time that Thomas More is being arrested, over in France, a very different scene is taking place. There is a young Spaniard with a limp who is attending the University of Paris at the Sorbonne, taking classes there. And he is an incredibly attractive character for people who have a strong sense of their own spiritual life. He is very attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And other young men, mainly Spaniards, gathered around him. And eventually they went, this was in 1534, on August 15th, they went to a very holy site in Paris. It's a hill over opposite from the Notre Dame, and it's called the Montmartre. It means the Mountain of Martyrs. And this was a spot where early church martyrs were executed, were martyred in back in Roman times. And so this is a very holy spot. Eventually, in the late 19th century, there would be a new basilica built there, the Church of the Sacré-Cœur, which is there today. It's one of the remarkable sites of Paris. And Anyway, this young man by the name of Don Iñigo López de Loyola brings these other men together, and there they made a vow, an oath, to live together in poverty, in chastity, in God's service. And then, specifically, they offered their service directly to the Pope, so that this institute would be a pontifical institute. Ignatius is 43 years old when he leads these other men into becoming companions.
Where did Ignatius come from?
He's from Spain.
The name Ignatius, though, that's not the name you said just a minute ago, was it?
Ignacio.
Oh, Ignacio,
yeah.
You did. Okay, I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, I just kind of Spanishized
it. Just everything else.
Yeah.
I should have caught Ignacio, though.
Over time, he would be known by the Latin name, Ignatius,
mm-hmm.
Right? Uh-huh. Ex-soldier. Most people know the story of how he got wounded. He was a commander at a city.
Mm-hmm.
The French fired some cannonballs early one morning. One of them ricocheted off the side of the wall and hit his leg, broke his leg. He was then field rested. The leg was set. He was then sent back to Loyola to recuperate with his family, got back, and the family doctor realized that the battle setting was incorrect and had to break his leg again and then reset it. But the end result was that his leg would never be what it should be for a soldier, and so his military career was ended. While he was at home recuperating, he asked to have the family library brought up to him, and both books were brought up. But remember, books were very expensive back then. And one of the books that was brought up was The Life of Christ, and then also The Lives of the Saints. And what's so important, especially about this Life of Christ, it had been written by a German mystic, and it had been translated into Spanish through the efforts of Jiménez de Cisneros. And with the intention of disseminating this book. So here you have a case, and we're going to see this so often in this century, in which saints are made saints by the company of saints.
All right.
You know, and so here you have a German mystic whose works are translated by a Spanish reformer, this great Franciscan, Jiménez de Cisneros, and then it finds itself into the hands of Ignatius of Loyola, and Ignatius is laying there, and so then eventually he's able to get around, takes all of his military hardware, all of his goods, his boots, all of this, and he goes off to basically a flea market and sells all of this stuff, gets rid of all of his stuff. He changes his life entirely, goes to Manresa, where he spends 8 months, and then he writes his Ignatian exercises, his spiritual exercises, and then at the same time takes the exercises himself. And with this, he goes to Jerusalem to join the Franciscans, who right away realized that he was too hot to handle, and he sent him back home instead. So he gets back to Spain, not entirely sure what to do, because he couldn't join the Franciscans and couldn't join the Jesuits because there weren't any yet.
Can't be in the military.
Yep, can't be in the military. So instead he becomes a student. And he goes to University of Alcalá, which is a relatively new university, once again set up by Jiménez de Cisneros,
mm-hmm.
founded by him. He studies there for a while, goes on then to Barcelona, to Salamanca, and then we find him going to Paris. Here's where then he establishes the Companions, which eventually will become the Society of Jesus, or the
mm-hmm.
Jesuits. He eventually will add obedience to the vows,
mm-hmm.
and then submits the document to Rome. In September of 1540, the Society of Jesus is then recognized. It's going to be very shortly after, within 13, 15 years, that the Society is going to play in a very important role in giving Council Fathers, leadership, many of the pariti at this council will be Jesuits themselves. So they have to move pretty fast in educating themselves and then preparing themselves for their work and then being called upon so early on then at the Council of Trent. And just tremendous role that they play there. You could say a lot about the Society of Jesus right from the very beginning. It is well organized. It is nothing less than a religious campaign to win back the losses. And you can see that this is happening quite rapidly, quite early on. There's a three-prong approach that the Jesuits use, and right from the very beginning. And the first is religious education. That's going to be mm-hmm. the most important thing, is to set up schools, and very, very good schools that are going to attract young men, boys, from the most influential families in any particular area. Now, you might say that this is catering to the rich, but from the Jesuit point of view, what it's doing is it's catering to the leaders of the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to want to bring in the leaders of the next generation and really convert them in a real sense. I mean, convert Catholics
right.
to a real sense of the Gospels, so that this next generation, as they take their role as mayors of cities and captains of industry and civil leaders and statesmen and everything else, that they're going to be able to spread then the Gospel into the leadership of the next generation and therefore change society for the better. So that's their number one goal, and they maintain this to this day. And then second is to bring mission activities to the infidels and to the new lands. And once again, they're going to be the Spanish monarchs who are in charge of the evangelization of the New World are going to use the Jesuits in the most difficult of situations. You know, they'll be sent. If you look at Mexico itself, you know, the areas that are given over to the Jesuits are the areas you'd go like, I don't think I want to go there. You know, they've got a lot of poisonous snakes there. That's like the Yucatan Peninsula, Quintana Roo, the state of Quintana Roo. Those are beautiful areas, and they're famous now for, you know, like Cancun now. But back in those days, those were really, I mean, I would rather be in a number of other areas I could name in Mexico rather than in those areas. But that's that, and they loved it. Mm-hmm. You know, and the same thing with the Far East. We'll look a little bit later on at the evangelization efforts by people like Francis Xavier mm-hmm. and Matteo Ricci, another generation after that. And they're just really, you have to admire them. And then thirdly, and this is where they're also very successful, is countering and contesting Protestants mm-hmm. at all stages and in all lands. And so, in other words, they're not going to surrender over the Protestant arguments.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to school themselves and then go out and be true apologists for the Catholic faith. And certainly, we can see right away. You know, here you have again saints being made saints in the company
right.
of saints. In that first generation, you've got people like Francis Borgia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who's the great grandson of Pope Alexander the VI.
Hmm.
And see how in two generations how that family has gone.
Right.
You know, because Alexander the VI is one of those characters that we would just as soon not think too much about. And then you have his great grandson, not only a Jesuit, but also a great organizer and one of the generals of the Jesuit order.
Mm-hmm.
At contemporary, you have Francis Xavier, once again, one of the original companions and a great name in mission work, which we'll look at later on. Also in this same generation, Aloysius Gonzaga,
mm-hmm.
you know, known for his zeal and his purity. Here's a young man who dies in the plague also, just like Charles Borromeo, caring for the plague victims. Well, we'll see this later on how all of this plays out, and then we can shift over to Spain also, and there's just tremendous things going on there. this once again sort of the next generation after De Cisneros. You have Teresa of Avila. Mm-hmm. You know, the year that Thomas More was beheaded, and the same year that Ignatius began his spiritual journey with his companions, it's the same year that Teresa joined the Carmelites. Isn't that something? You know, it comes together. And she joins the great Carmelite monastery at Avila. For the next several years, she is, one would have to say, honestly, and she did herself, a lax Carmelite. Mm-hmm. You know, she was almost an invalid. She had people wait on her, and she was just kind of lazy and all this. And around the age of 40, she had a deep spiritual sense that came over her. And everything changed. Her mm-hmm. whole perspective on life changed. And she found that the Carmelites were now too lax for her. And so she is given permission to establish a primitive house and to live, and other women joined her in living closer to the Carmelite ideal that goes back, of course, to the, what was it, 12th century, mm-hmm. when the Carmelites first began gathering, men at that point began gathering around Mount Carmel, living as hermits, and eventually forming together this community that becomes the Brotherhood of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, and then spreads throughout the centuries. And her spirituality is just going to be so incredibly important. First of all, she, once again, saints being saints in the company of saints, she is going to inspire a young Carmelite male by the name of John of the Cross, who himself is going to try to reform the Carmelites in Spain among mm-hmm. Among the male members. She herself will go on to write a number of books at the behest of the sisters, the first one being The Life, which is an autobiography, and then two really spiritual treasures, the first being The Way of Perfection, mm-hmm. and then the best known is Interior Castle. And I would recommend to anybody those books, but especially if you're just getting started, get a hold of Archbishop Albert Hughes' book, The Spiritual Masters, and he has a whole chapter that deals just with that, which helps to introduce the interior castle, mm-hmm. which is a little difficult to get into.
It is.
You know, you feel like it's kind of storming the castle when you're trying to read that book. But Archbishop Hughes does a great job at introducing it in a reader-friendly kind of a style.
I know, yeah. When I first tried reading it, I even got a tape series. I just listened to it on tape because I couldn't get through the book. And it took me a few times to get through the tapes so I could get there.
Yeah, yeah. I've been carrying around. For years, I'd had a copy of a poem that John of the Cross had written. And then there's a commentary that he did off of the poem itself. And I probably have tried starting that about five or six times. And it was only this past summer that I sat down during my own annual retreat and really delved into it. And it just, you know, after you come at it from so many different times, then all of a sudden it just opens up to you.
Uh-huh.
And it becomes this really beautiful thing to meditate on and kind of wash in, you know. But some of this stuff is really kind of tough.
It is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are lots of other saints that we could be talking about. We will be talking about a number of others. They're sort of like tiers of saints. We've got these incredible saints that are standing out right now, and then there's going to be another level that we're going to talk about, and then they're going to affect another level later on in history. So that when you get into, and we're talking only 1500s here, late 1400s and 1500s, when we get into the 1600s, there are going to be still a lot of just incredible saints, and then they're going to affect saints in the late 1600s. So we'll see how this goes. But there's one other that I really want to talk about before we go off and into some of those others. And another superstar, you could call, and that would be Francis de Sales.
Wow.
And we started this program with one of his favorite quotes, "You can catch more flies with honey than you can with vinegar."
See, I did not know that was from him.
Yeah, and I don't know where. I came across that in a book, and but I couldn't tell you exactly whether that was from a homily someplace, mm-hmm. or one of his retreats. Of course, he's famous for his retreats.
Mm-hmm.
One of the saints that's going to be affected by him through his retreats is, of course, Jane Frances de Chantal.
Right.
Yeah, but we'll talk a little bit more about her and about that a little bit later. He was born later in the game. He's born around 1567.
Okay,
so after the Council of Trent has already been finished a mm-hmm. couple years. I believe Martin Luther is already dead by this time. And so he's toward the end of that. But I want to say some things about him because he's such a superstar. And then we'll go back over and look at some lesser-known saints during this period too. He's born in northern Italy in the area around Savoy, which is sort of a Franco-Italian area. He is a bright young man, takes a doctorate in civil law, and then goes back and gets another doctorate wow. in canon law at the University of Padua. Having now become a double lawyer, he decides that he's not going to give himself over to politics after all. Instead, he turns to the church. And in 1593, is ordained and begins winning over Calvinists. At the age of 32, he became an auxiliary bishop. At the age of 35, he then became the ordinary, the bishop of Geneva, Switzerland.
35.
Yeah. Now,
which I guess you're talking, I just got to recall that we're talking 1500, so.
Yeah, and that's young.
Right.
Yeah, that's young. But remember, he's got two PhDs.
Uh-huh.
He's a real go-getter. And then also, quite honestly, being given the Diocese of Geneva is not exactly a plum. I mean, you know,
okay.
that's John Calvin's city of God.
Okay, you know? Right.
So he's kind of walking right. into a, yeah. And he's there for 20 years.
Wow.
And during that time, there are tremendous conversions, people coming back to the faith, leaving Calvinism. Remember the other day we talked about Calvinists trying to grapple with this problem of apostates from Calvinism.
Right.
And they came up with this idea of temporary faith.
Uh-huh.
You know,
that's right.
And so this once saved, always saved, temporarily kind of thing, maybe. Yeah. Well, one of the reasons they had to come up with that was because of people like Francis de Sales, who was converting people back. Now, how was he doing that? He was doing it through the love of God.
Mm.
He was doing it through the honey.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in two of his works, and one of them is, once again, I just really recommend, The Introduction to the Devout Life,
mm-hmm.
and the other is The Treatise on the Love of God. And once again, I would go back to Archbishop Hughes for the introduction in his book, Spiritual Masters, because he does a wonderful job at introducing Francis de Sales and the milieu in which he lived and worked, and also his ideas and the introduction to the spiritual life. So you could start out with that. Ultimately, he will, besides being the Bishop of Geneva, he will also be, sort of by accident, the co-founder of the Vincentian Order. And that, of course, working with Jane Frances de Chantal.
Mm-hmm.
Because besides being the Bishop of Geneva, he was also giving conferences and retreats in different parts of France, mainly. And he would go to Dijon in southern France, known, of course, mainly today for its mustard. But he would go and give retreats. And one of the women who would take these retreats, along with many others, was the wife of the Baron de Chantal. She was a good Catholic woman, serious about her faith, and raising her family. She had four children. And in the midst of all of this, her husband was killed in a hunting accident.
Mm.
And so besides raising her children, she also continued working even more vigorously, working for the sick and for the poor of the area around Dijon and all. She was inspired by Francis de Sales in his sermons, and in 1610, she, along with him, founded what was known as the Visitation Confraternity. And her intention there was to set up a different kind of approach. We're going to see the same thing with an earlier foundress, with the Ursulines. Angela Merisi has a very unique idea about a new kind of religious life, and she's going to found the Ursuline sisters in this very new way. And then ultimately, after she's dead, the church will come in and try to normalize that way of life, kind of pushing it back into a cloistered position. The same thing happens with the Vincentians. I mean, the Visitations. The idea behind the Visitation Confraternity was to be an active religious life, teaching, especially young women, in the world and without being of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and but ultimately the bishops in that area were just too uncomfortable with mm-hmm. this kind of approach, and so they're going to kind of move the sisters right back into the cloister again. And so in both of the cases, both with the Visitation and with the Ursulines, you're going to see the church very early on moving out into a new form of religious life, which in the next century is going to become an area of tremendous growth. So many religious orders that are going to be founded over the next several centuries based upon the model that these two orders of women are actually the prototypes of. You know, you go from hermits mm-hmm. to monasteries mm-hmm. and mendicants, you know, with Franciscans, Dominicans, and now this is a move that's active, into the active religious, and we'll see so much growth taking place in that, but not right now.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, those are the superstars. Now, if we have time, let's go ahead and take a look at the next tier of saints that are less well known, but still tremendous
famous,
in themselves.
Right.
You know, and what I did was I went ahead and I took a look at this era, and I broke them into two groups. Those who were alive at the time of Martin Luther's 95 Theses, and then those who were not yet born during that time, but were alive at the time of the Battle of Lepanto.
Okay.
A little fun way of playing with dates. The first, both of them are in the 1500s,
mm-hmm.
but the one is 1517, and the other is 1571. So it's an easy way of remembering the two and sort of just cluster the two sets of saints around those events. If you take 1517, so this is the, you know, we were talking about waves of saints, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is like the first wave
okay.
of saints coming through. In 1517, you had Angela Merisi, already 43 years old,
mm-hmm.
and very much underway. You also had St. Cajetan down mm-hmm. in Italy, mm-hmm. in Chieti, and we'll see how he interacts with a number of other saints. Jerome Emiliani,
mm-hmm.
36 years old. Michael Ghislieri, we don't know very much, no, wouldn't it, but he eventually becomes Pope. And he becomes Saint Pope Pius V.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and then Philip Neri, who is 2 years old
okay.
at this moment. So those are the saints that are not as well known as these superstars, but nonetheless have tremendous influence within mm-hmm. their own sphere. Let's take Angela Merisi first of all. As a young girl, she was orphaned. She joins the Third Order of Franciscans. As we've already talked a little bit earlier about the tremendous number of Third Order Franciscans throughout history,
mm-hmm.
I mentioned that around mm-hmm. 1900 there were a million members. Well, she's one, and in 1535, now she's 61 years old, she founds the Ursulines,
okay.
Named after St. Ursula, which would be the patron saint. The idea was that these women would live in the world and that they would be of service to their neighbors. They vowed celibacy,
mm-hmm.
but they would live in their own homes. Okay. So think about this. Think about a town, someplace, or a city in which there would be 4, 5, 6 women, each of them living in their own homes. You know, they might be caring for their elderly parents, mm-hmm. or they might just be unmarried,
mm-hmm.
and they've made a vow of celibacy, to live a celibate life, and so they spend their entire time, much as those early Christian widows that St. Paul talks about, spending their time mm-hmm. in service to the church. And so that's what they would do. In a sense, they're the forerunners of a secular institute.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
but there's nothing in canon law that defines that
right.
in the 1500s. Mm-hmm. Well, she died in 1540. And at the time of her death, there were 24 branches
wow.
of Ursulines already operating in the world.
Wow.
25 years later, finally, the authorities in the church just do not understand how these women could live good celibate lives, be holy women, do the apostolic work of the Ursulines without the support of community life. And so they said, look, you can't survive like this. You've got to live in cloister. You have to wear a habit. I mean, we've done it for, you know, we've been doing this for 1,500 years. We know what we're doing. And so the Ursulines then were normalized in a mm-hmm. sense. They were brought into cloisters. They prayed the office together. They wore a habit. And so here you have the first great experiment into what would be a secular institute or even into the earliest experiments of active religious,
mm-hmm.
and it's sort of pulled back into the tried and true method
mm-hmm.
of monasticism.
Okay.
Yeah. At the same time, this is going on in the little city of Chieti, which is over on the Adriatic Sea. You have a dynamic young man by the name of Cajetan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are two Cajetans who are contemporaries. One is Cardinal Cajetan.
Okay.
He's the one who is the legate sent by Pope Leo X to try to bring Martin Luther back into an obedience with Rome
right.
and fails to do that. This is a different Cajetan. Okay. This Cajetan was ordained in 1517. Same year as Martin Luther's 99 mm-hmm. Theses, and he had the opportunity to attend or to be around the Fifth Lateran Council. This was the great council of reform that didn't take off. Remember that they called for all these reform measures in like May, June of 1517.
Mm-hmm.
All the bishops went back to their dioceses. A half dozen of them actually implemented
mm-hmm.
the changes. Most of them waited around to see what would happen. And on October 31st, Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses. And well, we know what happened.
Right.
Anyway, Cajetan then goes back to Chieti. He gets back there around the same time that that Bishop Carafa has been sent from Spain, where he had been a chaplain at the royal court. And this is John Pedro Carafa, and he goes to Chieti then as bishop, and he and St. Cajetan will co-found together the Oratory of Divine Love.
Okay.
Okay. This is an organization of laymen as well as priests who get together on a regular basis, who pray, who monitor their religious life. And one of the things they did also was that there's a new disease that's been recently introduced to Europe in the last 30 or 40 years that is absolutely devastating, very deadly, and everyone knew where it came from. It's
mm-hmm.
called syphilis.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how you get it. And people who were getting it were, in many cases, being sent off, unless you're King of England, like Henry
mm-hmm.
VIII, who also died of the disease. If you weren't lucky enough to be a king, you were sent off to a hospice to die.
Okay.
You know, and the priest and laity of the Oratory of Divine Love took on the specific task of caring for these syphilitic victims in the last months and years of their life.
Okay.
In many cases, this is the parallel of AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. we know that the vast majority of AIDS comes from sexual promiscuity. It's not the only way that mm-hmm. AIDS strikes, but it's one way. And so there is has been, and we certainly knew this throughout the 80s and 90s, a real stigma against these people and terrible prejudice against AIDS victims. And yet there are those people who step up to the plate. And if you remember maybe back in the 80s where it was a real challenge for doctors as well as for priests to go into the room not knowing, you know, can I catch AIDS from drinking out of the same,
right.
you know. There was a lot of myth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the same thing was true about syphilis.
Mm-hmm.
And no, you know, we all knew the way to get it, but we didn't know how it would spread.
Mm-hmm.
And these very brave people from the very beginning put aside their own personal safety and their own personal prejudice and their own fears and took care of these people. You know, it's quite remarkable. In 1523, St. Cajetan will help the priests organize into a specific organization known as the Clerks Regular, are using the Latin term of the of the city of Chieti, they become known as the Theatines.
Oh, okay.
So this is where that order came from. And I think I'd mentioned before the Theatines.
Mm-hmm.
And while there were never many of them, they were nicknamed the Seminary of Bishops because so many of them became
right. mm-hmm.
bishops. They were very influential in combating Lutheran ideas both in Venice and in Naples. And especially when you think about Naples, because eventually Bishop Carafa then is sent to Naples to become the Cardinal Archbishop of Naples. Mm-hmm. One of those touched, once again, saints in the company of saints, one of those touched by all of this was Jerome Emiliani,
okay.
another saint from a family in Venice, a noble family, had intended to have a military career. Eventually, he was captured in battle and imprisoned by the imperial troops. He had been fighting against the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And while in battle, he had a personal, while in prison, he had a personal conversion and decided to give his life to Christ rather than to Mars. And for the next 3 years, after he was paroled out, he spent 3 years then working among the poor until he himself fell ill and was sent off to a hospice. He recovered, but at the same time, the experience of being in this hospital just told him that there was just terrible care for mm-hmm. for the sick. And so after he recovered, he went back to his house, which was really a mansion, and he converted his whole mansion into an orphanage so that the children of his area who are orphans would not have to suffer this terrible degradation of the of these institutions. He founds a small order of priests, and ultimately he himself dies of the plague in 1540. Another one who was touched by the example of Saint Cajetan and Cardinal Carafa is Michael Ghislieri from Bologna. He's one who at the tender age of 14, joins the Dominicans. This is 1 year after Martin Luther's 95 Theses. So
okay.
It's in 1518 he joins the Dominicans. 10 years later, he will be ordained. And then as a Dominican priest, he's then sent off to be a professor at a university, which he does for a while until he is elected provincial. Eventually, because of such a great mind that he has, he is made the commissioner of the Roman Inquisition and made a bishop and then made a cardinal by Pope Paul IV, Carafa.
Okay.
He ultimately will be the successor of the successor of mm-hmm. the pope who makes him a cardinal. In 1566, he himself becomes pope. The Council of Trent has just been concluded, and he implements the reforms of Trent in many ways. First of all, the breviary that we had, actually that we have today, is a variation off of the breviary that he reestablishes, so that that there is much greater instruction through the office of readings.
Okay.
For the priests and the religious that are using this prayer, the missal,
mm-hmm.
The Tridentine rite that we have in the church is a result of this. He repopularizes St. Thomas Aquinas, a scholasticism which a lot of people said was dead in the water and would never rise again, is repopularized. Interestingly enough, every several generations, St. Thomas is rediscovered, you know, and so much of the wealth of his wisdom is added. It's actually in Pius V's reign that Thomas Aquinas is then designated as a doctor of the church.
Oh, okay.
St. Pius V does that. He's also responsible for the catechism. And the reason why the catechism is so important is that he believes that the strength of the church is going to come through the teaching by the parish priests in their parishes to instruct the children and instruct adults who are preparing for their own baptism.
Mm-hmm.
So this becomes so much, so important. He will be so successful in the church and so unsuccessful in diplomacy. He is going to run afoul of the Holy Roman Emperor, Maximilian mm-hmm. II, who quite honestly has begun to compromise with we'll be looking later on at the compromise that they make in Germany, recognizing Lutheranism and recognizing a permanent split in Christendom.
Mm-hmm.
Maximilian is going to recognize that. Pope Pius V is going to hang on to hope that somehow Christianity could be reconciled and that a permanent split would not take place. So he runs himself afoul of the emperor on that, who is making political compromises. He runs afoul of Elizabeth I of England because he supports the claim of Mary of Scots mm-hmm. as the legitimate monarch. Obviously, Mary is beheaded by Elizabeth in this incredible act of regicide,
mm-hmm.
killing of a monarch. And in 1570, Elizabeth will be formally excommunicated from the church by the Pope, but there's no way for the people of England to know about this.
Mm.
However, two Jesuits smuggled themselves into England with the bull of excommunication and nail it on a public building in London. They're captured, tortured, and ultimately executed themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that Pius is so known for is he's the one, as much as he was unsuccessful at those two diplomatic efforts, he's the one who is successful in pulling together an alliance of Venetians, Spanish, and papal navies that then go to the east and successfully contest at the Battle of Lepanto against the Ottoman Turkish Navy.
Okay.
It gives breathing room. And so as a result of that, we have the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary, the naming of Mary as the Queen of Victories, as the Help of Christians. And this is going to be the last great thing that he will do, and he'll die 1 year later in 1572.
All right.
There's only one other saint involved in this that we would want to talk about. Maybe we'll put this off until next time and start out with St. Philip Neri.
Oh, yeah.
And he's also sort of a transitional saint. He and Camillus the Lellis, and then with that, then we'll start looking at this second wave that takes place after that.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Father. We close the prayer for us
today.
Sure.
Okay. On this particular day, we remember Our Lady under the title of Mount Carmel. And so we ask God to shower His blessings upon the Carmelites all throughout the world. We thank God for the many gifts of Carmelites throughout the many centuries. And we just pray the prayer of Mary. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit.